You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis.
This is CNN.
That was the voice of James Earl Jones delivering the familiar intro to the network known as the most trusted name in news. This June is the 40th anniversary of CNN, which may come as a surprise to some of you, given that the popular narrative of the first 24-hour news network often begins with its coverage of the first Gulf War in 1991. But CNN had actually been on the air for over a decade by that point, and now author Lisa Napoli gives an entertaining inside look at the early years of the upstart network that set out to change the world in her new book, Up All Night: Ted Turner, CNN, and the Birth of 24-Hour News. And today, Lisa joins me on the show where she reveals that few people took Ted Turner seriously when he entered broadcasting, thanks to his persona as a wild, womanizing playboy. And she shares how Turner went from hating the news to founding the first all-news network in the basement of a rundown former country club in Atlanta. She talks about the skeptics who questioned whether there was enough news to fill a whole day, and how being on the air 24 hours gave CNN a decided advantage over the big three networks. We also discussed Ted Turner's political evolution, his flirtation with running for president, and his unlikely friendship with Fidel Castro. Then we look back on the impact of Ted Turner on his network years later, and the lasting impact of CNN on how news is delivered and consumed today. Coming up with Lisa Napoli in just a moment. Lisa Napoli is a journalist who has worked at the New York Times, Marketplace, MSNBC, and KCRW. She is the author of two previous books, Radio Shangri-La and Ray and Joan. But before all of that, she began her career as an unpaid teenage intern at CNN's New York Bureau in the summer of 1981. And now she's written about that fledgling news network that gave her her start in her latest book. It's called Up All Night: Ted Turner, CNN, and the Birth of 24-Hour News. Lisa Napoli, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Well, CNN is enjoying its 40th anniversary this month, and you were there in some way almost from the start. Is it weird for you to think that many people, including probably a lot of people listening right now, may have no association of CNN and its founder, Ted Turner? Or more than that, many people today probably have no memory of a time when there wasn't at least one 24-hour news network.
It's pretty scary. I was talking to a guy in the Netherlands the other day who told me he was born in 1990, and that he, of course, didn't remember a time before any of the things that we, you know, take for so for granted. But it's part of getting older is having that experience. I remember with my grandfather saying, "You mean there was not television always?" So, you know, it's always something.
Yeah. And your book is a wonderful snapshot of a really wild and fascinating time in CNN's history, starting with the early days of Ted Turner and CNN and leading up to the baby Jessica and the well story from 1987. But for right. most people, the popular narrative of CNN starts with the Gulf War and Bernie Shaw and the CNN crew hunkered down in a hotel in Iraq, delivering this live footage of U.S. missiles raining all over Baghdad. In the myth yeah. of CNN, it's almost as if it didn't exist before that moment. But prior to that, CNN, I guess, had been up and running for over a decade. I wonder, what do we miss by overlooking that Wild West era of CNN?
Well, that's why I wrote this book. I think it's so fascinating to look at the real origin story of any of these vaunted institutions. My last book was about McDonald's, and not about McDonald's today, but how McDonald's got to the point where it became McDonald's. And the same thing here with CNN. The parallels are very interesting because like McDonald's, CNN almost didn't make it, and it didn't have a wide audience to begin with. And it's hard to imagine life without it. But yes, it had basically, what do they call it in the internet business? A soft launch, when you put up a website or a podcast and you don't advertise it right away. That's really what CNN was doing inadvertently when it started. And I, you know, my story is not at all involved in this story. It was just that's in the press release for the book, just to say that was what sparked my curiosity as I've gotten older. How did this institution come to be? And many of the people who worked there, who were there in the weeds at that moment, don't even realize it because they were too busy trying to get the damn thing off the ground.
Yeah. So. And you did get your start at CNN, like I said, as a summer intern in 81, which was only a year after it first hit the airwaves. What was it like being there in their New York bureau in those very early days?
Well, it's so interesting to point out that there was no cable in New York City, in the boroughs of New York City. I grew up in Brooklyn, so I didn't even really know what it was. It wasn't like I sought it out. You know, I would have loved to have gotten an internship at the New York Times, but I was a poor kid from Brooklyn, the first person in my family to go to college. I mean, that was just unthinkable. So somebody just basically told me that they saw this thing in the base of the World Trade Center, because that's where they rented space. It was sort of an off-market location. And, you know, I called up and they said, come in and here's an internship, like answer the phones, kid. But it wasn't like a formal internship or anything like that. So for me, it was just dazzling. And it was amplified by the fact that, you know, cameras and lights and microphones are always dazzling. But the idea that not only was it new, and not only were most of the people running around there young, and not only was it 24 hours, but we couldn't even see it. I couldn't go home and watch with my family because we didn't have it. So it was kind of nebulous and strange, and it just seemed like a good thing to have on my resume. And of course, when I got out of school, it was a logical place to hit up for a job. And that's what's also so interesting. It's not like, you know, it's hyper competitive to not just get a job there, but to get an internship there now. But the place was engined by people like me in the early days. It could never have existed if it didn't have people willing to work for below minimum wage and crazy hours to get on the air.
Yeah, that's one of the things that comes out in the book is CNN didn't want to pay to get someone who was a 10-year veteran of the business. So they kind of had a training program. So they would take some kid and within, say, 2 months, they could give them as much experience as someone who had been working in the business for a decade.
And it's not that they didn't want to. It's just that they couldn't afford it. And because they headquartered in Atlanta, they were able to skirt the union, because we're not skirt the union, to avoid a union. And so that allowed them to just basically hire anybody they wanted. And, you know, there were people who had experience who were willing to take the risk to either get out of a local market for the chance to do national news. But more so, it was people like me. And those early pioneers, those first 300 people, if you lined them up, and I did try to put together a list, I could never find the first employee, you know, the earliest employee list. But when you look at all of them, they had a really interesting array of experiences, even the kids who were recent college graduates. So they just all had this vision and this dream that maybe this would work. And if it didn't, they'd just all go somewhere else and get a job somewhere else.
Did the fact that CNN was based in Atlanta present a lot of problems when it came to finding talent and trying to lure them down there?
That, and also it was a problem because their marquee show was a 10 o'clock live talk show, which sounds very quaint and retro, but then that was revolutionary that television would do something like that where people could call in, and they wanted a live studio audience. And in Atlanta, in Midtown Atlanta, which was kind of a dicey part of town at that point, at 10 o'clock at night on a weeknight, it was really hard to get people. Plus, it was hard to get guests. It's not like today where, you know, you can Skype into Jimmy Kimmel from your den on your laptop. It was a whole different world technologically. Mm-hmm. And even though the technology is what allowed CNN to start, it was not really possible to just beam up from anywhere. So there was, that wasn't a normal stop on the stop of politicians or authors on book tour. So there were a lot of impediments in the very beginning. That was once they got on the air. So.
And in those days, the CNN headquarters in Atlanta was operated out of this old rundown country club, right? Can you paint a picture of what that was like?
Yes, that was another fascinating thing. And researching it, I should have been an architectural writer because I'm just fascinated about buildings and first buildings. And the first location for CNN after they started, the earlier location for the office was also interesting. But this was an old country club that was basically left for dead in Midtown Atlanta, behind next to Georgia Tech and behind I think it was the nation's largest housing project. And it was it looked like they called it Tara on Techwood. You know, you want to make a movie out of it, except that it was more of a horror movie right then because the columns were decrepit and there were rats running everywhere. It had been uninhabited. The country club had moved out years before. So Ted Turner bought it for a song because it was a perfect place to house not just CNN, but at that point, TBS. And of course, wrestling was one of the mainstays of WTBS in those early years. And so the wrestling would actually happen above the news studio. So while the anchors were reading their newscasts, you'd have huge guys throwing each other around above the studio. So it was, it's a movie waiting to happen. Yeah. It's such a crazy thing, but it was the perfect place. And, there was enough space also for the satellite dish farm, which again, I've got my iPhone here. That's a satellite dish farm. But back in 1980, to have six or seven satellite dishes that were receiving signals from all around the world was nothing short of, it was the largest array of satellite dishes, if not military, non-military, anywhere. So there was space, they just glossed over the swimming pool or filled in the swimming pool and put in the dishes. So it was a pretty crazy place to work. I feel lucky that I showed up enough time to work there because it was a fascinating location.
Yeah, it's so entertaining just to hear how so many elements of it were just kind of made up as they went along. And I've heard from someone who used to work in the early days of TBS. He told me that Ted Turner pretty much lived within the building most of the time. Yeah. And sometimes he would be watching an old movie on his own station late at night. And if he didn't like it, he'd just go down to the control room in the basement, stop the movie in the middle of it, and put on something else.
It was truly his TV station. Yes. Oh, yes. And the stories of him walking through the halls, drinking, after having been drinking. And it was like a big frat party, that place. And yet the people there were doing really fun things and having a great time. And they were revolutionizing television simply by dint of putting themselves up on cable and then up on the satellite. But I think it's so important to talk about these things because when we see, it's like seeing a beautiful movie star who's just come out of makeup. I want to see what she looks like before she's gone into makeup. I want to see what it's like, how it got to that point. And that's how this is so interesting because I don't think anybody can believe what it was, what the building blocks here were. It wasn't a calculated, let's sit down and build the world's most important network. No, it was not that way at all.
And we have to spend some time talking about the man who started it all. Talk about a singular individual at a time when media is now just so corporate, I kind of miss a maverick personality like a Ted Turner. He almost reminds me of Howard Hughes in a way. But like, yes, Howard Hughes, he was a total playboy. So I wonder, when he was first launching TBS and CNN, are there very many people who took him seriously?
Well, that's what's so interesting, is that he was able to pull off what he did, given how lunatic he really was, and how many of the people who worked very closely with him and actually revered him thought he was a lunatic. I mean, there's stories of him going into advertisers or potential advertisers' offices and saying, you know, give me all your money, buy time on my little rinky-dink channel. And they say no. And he would get down on the floor and writhe. And you know, he was the absolute opposite of the Me Too political correctness. Not right. That Me Too is politically correct, but it, you know, he just embodied this era of insanity in the workplace, that just those of us who lived through it in various workplaces, you know, it's just odd that he got away with it, and that, yeah, it worked, that it all came together. But no, a lot of people did not take him seriously, mm-hmm, especially when it came to news, which is why he had to hire, you know, deputize a couple of highfalutin people from the news business, as highfalutin as he could get, because no one believed this guy could pull off news. Sports, one thing. He was the famous yachtsman. He owned the baseball team. But news was so sober and serious. And, you know, there was a code of ethic. And you would never do certain things or say certain things in news. And he was not the person anybody believed could do that.
I can't imagine that he would have survived today. I mean, a board would have voted him out within a week. Any human resources department worth their salt would have tossed him.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, yeah. There would have been a revolt. The women would have revolted. Although, yeah, it's interesting, because even close friends of his said that they would see him behave in ways that were so outrageous, and they were shocked that women didn't just belt him over the head. You know, it was amazing. I'm sure there were women who did, but and there, you know, there are many stories of men being angry about him with their women, and he got away. He got away with so much. He was singular. Yeah.
And he became just such a larger-than-life personality. In fact, you say in here that when he bought the Atlanta Braves, fans would come up to him for autographs before they would ask the players. I've always wondered how much of the uncensored wild man, the hard-drinking, womanizing, riverboat gambler persona was a stunt or an intentional publicity ploy versus just Ted being Ted.
I've talked to enough people that it sounds like it was real.
Really?
I mean, he might have turned up the notch a little bit when it was appropriate, when he needed to do it, but put on the dog. Mm-hmm. But he sounds like he was genuinely wild, unfiltered, just fearless, and just unstoppable, but also uncensorable. I mean, he just didn't, no filter. Yeah. It seems as much as you can tell. And when you write a book like this, you're relying on talking with people and reading and watching. If you watch the old yacht movies, the yacht movies are incredible, or him at baseball games. You know, in the moment of the yachting, I think he couldn't put it on. You know, of course, mediated reality, who the heck knows, but it seems pretty real.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't he win the America's Cup?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. In fact,
so he was a serious yachting.
Yeah. He was considered, and I didn't realize that when I started researching this. I knew that he, you know, played around with boats, but I didn't know how seriously and how well regarded he was. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, numerous times the Yachtsman of the Year. He was not a dilettante. He meant business, and he, you know, to watch it, even though I know next to nothing about boats, it's pretty spectacular to see the action. And there've been some amazing books written about that period. You wouldn't think a book could convey the ferocity of, the intensity of being on a yacht in competition in a storm, but they do. They're really great. Mm-hmm. So,
And one of the most interesting points that comes out in this book is just how uninterested he was in the news for throughout much of his career as a broadcaster. In fact, I think you say that he used to go around saying no news is good news.
Right.
He just wanted to run baseball games and the Andy Griffith Show and that kind of thing. What changed his mind?
Well, you know, I think it's so important. And that's another reason I wanted to write this book, because now we think of CNN as the house organ of the liberals, you know, Fox is the opposite, MSNBC, you know, however you slice and dice it, wherever your politics are, people interpret it differently. But that wasn't the case at all. Ted Turner was a conservative who kept his conservatism out of the news. He didn't want to do news because he just didn't like the way it was transmitted over the three major networks. But he didn't get into the news business because he wanted to change that point of view. He got into the news business purely because it was a way to use the marriage of the cable and the satellite, which was brand new at that time. And he wanted to do something big, something grand. He had put TBS up on this cable satellite so that the whole nation could see it. Back then it was Channel 17, WTCG, and it was such a wild success that people around the nation, I have to step back for a second. Ted was the first person to go 24 hours with television. There was a time when television did not go 24 hours. So Ted, with his little UHF station, ran movies all night long and crazy news shows and you know, all kinds of stuff and basic Ginsu knife commercials. And basically it did so well for him that he wanted to do something bigger. He saw that there was an appetite for round the clock something. He couldn't do sports because the sports he had were on his, he owned a number of teams and he played them on his main station, the UHF station, TBS, and he couldn't do movies because HBO had just staked a tiny claim in that world. HBO had just started. That's where he got the idea. HBO was not a major force the way it is today. It was on just several hours a day, licensing what content it could, and it was very hard to do that. And so he saw he couldn't compete with that. So it was kind of sitting around brainstorming with the guys that he came up with, maybe we could fill 24 hours a day with a bunch of news. How do we do that? Let's get me some guy who knows how to do that. Because is there enough news to fill that much time? And the answer on the part of some of them was maybe not, but you know, maybe we'll have to blow things up. They just didn't know. But they just thought it sounded good. So that's a long way of saying really it was technology that inspired the birth of 24-hour news. There were other people interested in it. You know, the news people were toying with the concept of it, but it was, like you say, a maverick. It took a maverick to say, oh yeah, I'm going to do it.
And another reason for this, you say in the book, is he was sort of afraid that the FCC was in the pocket of the big three networks. And if he went into entertainment or sports in a big way, they would push back. But no one really cared if someone went into 24-hour news, I guess.
Well, when you have to license, you know, that's the other thing. It's not the sexiest story in the world. But when you think about how crazy it was, if you were a film production company making a movie, and in the old days, you made the movie and it aired in a movie theater. And then later, much later, you licensed it to TV. And that was a whole outfit. Same thing with sports. You know, sports was licensed to a station, and they played the game, you know, they bought the rights to air the games, but it, you know, the whole idea of owning them and who put them on YouTube and who got the residuals when you played this movie later, or, I mean, none of that had been figured out. It's like I used to cover the early days of the internet, and the early days of the internet, every day, another thing came up, kind of like a pandemic. Every day it comes up. Oh my God. Well, how do we do that? What do we do with that? How do we deal with that? And that's what it was like in the 70s in television as cable was coming on. Wow. Nobody's ever thought about putting a UHF station from Atlanta, a little rinky dink station, on the air in Alaska. Wait, what are the rights issues about airing Star Trek and the Beverly Hillbillies in Alaska when I bought it just for Atlanta? And that was not an easy matrix to navigate. So basically, when, you know, faced with that, because he'd been facing that with TBS, there were many issues with broadcasting TBS nationally. Faced with that, why not just do something where all the content's original? And that's how news came up.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Imagine yourself with a doctorate at the top of your field. You could be teaching, researching, or making a bigger impact in your community. A doctorate can be a big investment in time or in money. But did you know that you could earn a degree from Capella University through a flexible program? From enrollment to graduation and beyond, you'll be guided every step of the way. Capella has over 25 years of online education experience supporting doctoral students, and they have $5,000, $10,000, and $20,000 Capella Progress Reward Scholarships for eligible new students enrolling in select doctoral degree programs. Capella also offers financial aid counselors, enrollment counselors, and career counselors to help you get started. Learn more about the support and resources you'll have from beginning to end. Start exploring available programs and scholarship opportunities at capella.edu/doctorate. That's capella.edu/doctorate. And I want to go back to something that you kind of touched on a moment ago, which is just how proud Ted Turner was of being Atlanta-based. He reveled in operating this quote-unquote Southern broadcast network like TBS that played to the tastes of regular folks. And in a lot of ways, Ted Turner's pronouncements against the big three networks and media elites and this idea that New York was the only place where news happened really seems to presage the kind of culture war rhetoric that we now expect from Fox News and other conservative outlets.
150%. It's so interesting that, you know, and this is true in every aspect of history. There's nothing new, right? I mean, I was just researching Anita Hill for a new book that I'm writing. And, you know, this sort of early birth of the Me Too movement was happening back in 1990. What year? I should know what year it was right now. 91, 80, 87. No, 91. But yes, exactly. Ted Turner, first of all, Atlanta was his home, so it wasn't a calculation,
right.
But Atlanta was his home. It was, you know, it made sense for him to have his network headquartered there, but he also really didn't like the media establishment. He felt that they sold the American people short. And of course, you know, in many ways, that's true. It's it is reflective only of the people who make it. That's why the whole push for diversity is so important that we have today. But that was happening back 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. The idea of diversifying didn't just mean people of color or women. It meant as much geography, and it meant as much it meant people who didn't come from this entrenched establishment. You know, I went to Harvard, you went to Yale, and we're all from very fancy families, and we have microphones in our face. Now, even a gal like me has a microphone in her face. But that was sort of the basis of his antagonism toward the media. He felt that they were not reflective of the rest of the nation. So, not, and again, it wasn't so much politically, although he was angry about how the Vietnam War had been depicted on network news. But it was really motivated by, he just felt like it was selling people short, other ideas short.
And you mentioned a moment ago that sort of the refrain from critics at the big three networks, it really broke down to two things. It was, who's going to want to watch news all day long, first of all, and how are you going to fill 24 hours of news? The networks only ran a half hour, an hour of national news every night. Did CNN have trouble coming up with enough content at first?
Well, it was very challenging because they didn't have what the networks had, which was an affiliate network of stations around the country, which had their own newscasts. And it wasn't that it was so easy for the networks at that point then, too, because videotape was just evolving. Portable cameras, which were not so portable by our standards today, were just happening. So basically, CNN had to go out and beg, borrow, and steal from other stations around the country when news erupted in various locations. But they also, you know, very wisely put together what you would call in a newspaper columnists. You know, they'd hired a number of people from a variety of viewpoints to do these essays or columns every week. So they had them on a shelf in the can, and, you know, if need be, they'd fill the time. But, you know, that's what I also was so excited about talking about you with, because, you know, I see the guests that you have on your show. I mean, we take so for granted this idea that author X or political pundit Y is coming on the show and we're going to butt heads for a half hour. That did not happen before CNN. Right. And CNN basically had to invent that, because what better way to kill time? You know, that and also the steady stream of stuff that comes out of a place like Washington, D.C., where somebody's giving a speech and somebody's having a press conference and there's some sort of commendation or congratulatory ceremony that we, the lay people, never saw before. But now all of a sudden, CNN needed to fill the time. And what better way to do it than to, you know, hey, the president's giving a boring, what would normally be just a totally boring speech. Let's air it for the people, because, you know, they've never seen the whole speech. They've only seen, you know, the big speeches or snips of the speech on the evening news. So, yeah, it was a big challenge. They were worried about it. They had reporters, but they didn't have that many reporters. They were not an international force yet, so they didn't have a huge raft of people around the world. And the technology was more portable, but it still wasn't like the iPhone, which is, you know, the studio in a phone. So it's just fascinating to think about what they were up against.
Well, now that we've talked about the challenges of trying to do a 24-hour news network, what kind of advantages did CNN have over the networks right out of the gate simply because it was a 24-hour news network?
That's a great question. And the president of CNN, who Ted had hired, Reese Schoenfeld, was a veteran newsman who for years had been railing against the problem with network news. He felt, as Ted did, that it was super homogenized. If you watched all three networks each night at 6:30, you would see basically the same stories. Basically, they all had read the main important newspapers in the morning. They basically didn't step out much from whatever was proscribed on those front pages. And that drove Reese Schoenfeld in particular crazy, because he wanted to do a couple of things. He wanted to buck that system and introduce new voices and new ways of telling stories. But the biggest vision that he had was that the story became the story, that you would watch the story unfold, as opposed to when you watch the network news, you would see, you know, a half hour of stories presented to you in a nice, neat little bow. And his idea was, when something happened, when something blew up somewhere or a president was shot, you would watch from the minute that news broke till there was a resolution. Now, of course, we now know the downside of that, but at that time, it was a very exciting prospect that you could watch the news unfold like an unscripted drama. Mm. We didn't call it that then, but they didn't call it that then. So that was an exciting piece of it. And I think, you know, obviously he was right. There is a huge appetite for that. We've seen it time and time again. Well, what we can talk about, whether it's good for society or good for our ulcer or good for anything. But it, you know, he was right.
And one event that you highlight is the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan as the perfect example of how a 24-hour news network could scoop the big three. What was unique about that situation?
Well, you know, they were inside while the president was giving in the hotel, was giving a speech, you know, sort of a standard speech to a union, AFL-CIO, and they had just run that speech. And they basically weren't part of the White House press pool at that point. They weren't allowed to join because they weren't union and they weren't seen as, you know, meritorious of that responsibility to be part of that White House press pool. But basically, they had wire service too, and they got this instant flash that bullets had been fired on the president. Nobody knew at that point who had been shot, if anybody had been, you know, if anybody had been hurt. But the bullets had rung out, and Bernard Shaw went on the air and said that, you know, there have been shots fired outside the Hilton Hotel where we've just been bringing you the president, and we'll tell you how it goes. Now, the networks did that too. CNN went to air first. The networks did that too, but they went away back to their soap operas because they were not a 24-hour news channel. But there they were on CNN. What were they going to do? Go back and do some feature report in China that had been running, or Japan? I can't remember where it was. There was some international report that was running when they interrupted it to bring this news. They could have gone back to that taped piece, but that wasn't the point. The point was to stay there and to fill and to tap dance and to fill. And somebody like Bernard Shaw, who, if anybody listening remembers, was just the consummate, gracious, you know, sober anchor man. You know, he wasn't, no histrionics. He was just very even keeled. He sat there knowing the gravity of shots on a president. Could this man have been hurt? What that meant in the larger sense. And he basically tap danced very eloquently, even though he had basically nothing to tap dance with. And as info dripped in, they delivered it, as did the networks. And the networks basically had to take note at that point that this was not a joke, this place. And, you know, they it wasn't like it resolved it overnight, but it helped show. It's like the little boy who picks up the bat and hits a home run. He's a little scrawny kid and shows off that, yeah, I can do it too. You could be making fun of me, but I did it. And that's what happened that day. And showed both the power of CNN, even though not that many people still were watching it, but the power of the concept of being on the air all the time.
And one of the weirder moments in sort of the Reagan era history of CNN is, not long after that, Ted Turner accepts an invitation to visit Fidel Castro in Cuba.
Yes.
Now, this was at a time when the president of the United States was taking a hardline stance on Castro, and Reagan, I believe, had ratcheted up the Cuba embargo. Yes. What did Ted Turner see as the upside to meeting with Castro? What was he hoping to gain from that meeting?
I think he was so dazzled by the invitation. And the reason he got the invitation is because Fidel Castro was stealing the signal of CNN. So it was so, you know, here's somebody who didn't take news seriously. He had, you know, strong opinions, but he wasn't a news guy. And all of a sudden, you're telling him, his reporter is coming back from Cuba and saying, hey, Ted, they want you to come visit. And you're hearing that, you know, the avowed enemy of the United States wants you to come visit. What a sense of importance that you get from that. You know, and he said there were, maybe I'll be kidnapped. Maybe they'll kill me. I don't know what's going to happen to me. But he couldn't say no. It was an invitation he just could not refuse. And it really was a transformational experience for him, because coming face to face with Fidel and going duck hunting and drinking rum and smoking cigars, it really showed him he may not agree politically with Fidel, and he certainly did not. He called him that commie pinko or something like that. But he might be a commie pinko, but he was a commie pinko, and he was a human, and he loved his kids, and he loved his cigars and his ducks and his girlfriend, and he just like Ted. And maybe if this service that he'd put together was useful to Fidel, maybe it was useful in the greater sense to helping the world unite somehow. And that's mm-hmm. where his early vision of that, of media as a sort of coalescing force came about. Of course, you know, we know in the end what really happened, but it was a dazzling moment for him. And it was a dazzling and very quaint and wonderful vision that he had. So,
I think you said that he used to fly the United Nations flag at CNN headquarters and talked about how they could bring about world peace through CNN.
World peace.
Oh, wow.
Unfortunately, no. We've got at least Yes, a war here. Oh, and yeah. Other people around the world have said to me just since this book came out, you know, what the heck? Right. And I'm like, I can't tell you about now. I can just tell you how it started.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
And how did Ted Turner's politics evolve over the years? Because apparently he was a pretty staunch Southern Republican when he was young, and now he's this avowed liberal on most issues, gives tons of money to environmental causes. Was it all Jane Fonda, or what changed in his politics?
No, you know, that's the other thing that's been hard to explain to people as I've been writing this book, who don't know about Ted Turner, because, you know, this is well before Jane Fonda. And, you know, I think, first of all, I don't know that the environment is necessarily always a liberal cause. I think,
right.
You know, we associate it that way. But I think that Ted Turner had an awakening that opened him up to more ideas, new ideas that he didn't imagine that he had before, because he wasn't a political beast, so to speak. I mean, he did vote Republican. He didn't vote for Jimmy Carter, the hometown boy. But he was one of those people who basically was raised a certain way, and so he believed a certain way until somebody said, you know, you don't have to think that. There's other ways. So it wasn't really Jane. It was long before Jane. It was more, I think, the power of seeing what this communications tool could potentially do and opening up to other ways of thinking and being that was transformational for him. But yeah, he gets a bad rap with the whole, not a bad rap, but it's Jane Fonda is a fascinating person, and their romance and love affair and courtship, all that, you know, even to this day, now that they've been divorced for so long, is fascinating. But this is well before that. And I'm sure she influenced him just the way any person married to another person would. But all of that he was an environmentalist back when he was, you know, in the 1970s, he was buying up, you know, huge lands, and he loved nature always. He's a hunter, which is obviously doesn't necessarily square up in my mind with environmentalism, but he has right. always loved and appreciated nature. So it seems like that's an extension of something that was just in him mm-hmm. from way back.
And I mentioned at the outset that you sort of bookend your story with the first live TV event in 1949 of a girl stuck in a well and the baby Jessica's story in 87.
Yeah.
What did you want to drive home about how live news coverage has changed or evolved in those four decades?
You know, I did that because I was so interested. I'm so interested, obviously, in the history of TV news, of communications, but I was so intrigued to find out that the very first television breaking news live shot was the subject of it was the very first ratings buster on, or ratings getter for CNN in 1987. So it was so interesting that people When KTLA in Los Angeles ran that live shot of a little girl, rescue of a little girl from a well in 1949, people around the world were rapt with attention. But there were critics who said, this is ridiculous. This is not news. This is, you know, base and horrible and cheap and tawdry. And that was in 1949. So when you fast forward to 1987, and, you know, here's this high-minded idea of seeing of news all the time on CNN with commentators and, you know, important discussions and news reports from important events. And then what's the thing that busts the rating charts is a little girl in a well being rescued. And so I think it just says something about, you know, we, first of all, it's an interesting story. People watched it till the end. But it says something about, you know, that probably not very good about us and how we want to see other people's stories, even when it's, you know, some poor little girl we'll never meet. And mm-hmm. thankfully in the Midland, Texas story, she lived. So, it was a happy, happy ending. But yeah, you know, I wanted people to sort of look at it and say, wow, you know, everything's not different, and yet the technology is completely different. The ease of transmission is completely different. But in the end, you know, the first guy who did that report in 1949, didn't know what to say. He looked at his boss and he said, okay, well, now while we're waiting for these men to dig this poor little girl out, what do I do? How do I fill the time? And they did what people have been filling the time on TV with since, just talking. And, talking and not really necessarily saying a whole lot.
Yeah.
So
yeah, for sure. Yeah. And even though you end your history of CNN in 87, you do have an afterword to the book set in 2000. That was a rough year for Ted Turner, both personally and professionally. How did he take that?
Well, you know, there have been many books written about the later part of Ted's life and his, you know, trying to purchase CBS, the failed purchase with MGM, and how he basically had to give up power or control of his business, which he'd never done before. And that dissolution began in the mid-80s as he had to let investors help basically bail him out, up until the year 2000, when the ultimate bailout happened, which was the sale of Time Warner, which had taken over CNN, to AOL in, you know, what is widely regarded as the worst business deal in history. And so in 2000, when CNN was celebrating its 20th anniversary, basically, you know, Jane was leaving him. He was losing what little toe he had left at CNN. And it was just a really terrible time for him. But reading the books about what happened once he, you know, the aftermath of what I write about, are really, really fascinating. Lots of interesting characters and, you know, important people in 20th century broadcasting, media, just everything. All the cable is a huge force. But it's fascinating just to see how Ted, who swore up and down for years that no one was going to get a piece of the action, basically had to give it up. And yeah, it's a sad story. But by then he'd given up so much anyhow. So it wasn't, you know, the ship had sailed a long time before.
Do you think his legacy is still felt at CNN, or are there noticeable ways in which the network has changed since Turner gave up control?
Oh my God. He'd never had day-to-day control. It's been decades since he had real control or real, you know, ownership of it. It was such a diluted ownership. I think, you know, it's very telling that when AT&T bought basically a lot of properties, including CNN, they're taking the Turner name off many of those properties, just erasing the name altogether. And, you know, in the halls of CNN, I wonder, I mean, there've got to be quite a lot of people like that Dutch journalist I was talking to the other day who were born in 90 and, you know, don't know Ted Turner except as maybe a name. So, yeah, I don't think that he's certainly CNN. If you go online and look at what CNN looked like in the very beginning, it doesn't look anything like it did. None of television does. Sure. None of us do. But it's a whole different animal, so to speak. And that's why, you know, this book is an interesting and tough sell, because it's not about CNN today or what it stands for today. And I don't think that most of the people who were there at the very beginning, at least the ones I've spoken to, are happy with what's happened to broadcast journalism, particularly that part of broadcast journalism that they work so hard to get off the ground.
And we live in a time when news has increasingly become politicized, and disinformation and even conspiracy theories are treated as legitimate news by many outlets. Is there a lesson before we go here that can be applied to this moment?
I wish I had one. I try to make sense of it all the time. I'm so grateful to be old enough to have worked over these last decades and to see this disintegration, basically, and not happy to see the disintegration, but to see the progression of the technologies. And I'm so happy not to have to be, you know, while I'm talking to you, looking at my phone at a Twitter feed and hoping that, you know, the president doesn't say something that I have to go run and do a story. I could never have imagined doing that. So no, I don't know. I wish I had a smart way to wrap it up in a bow, because I'm really worried. And that's why I love writing history, because it just keeps me out of the present moment, which isn't, you know, yeah. I guess the healthiest thing, but it's better than being yeah. obsessed with it in yeah. a negative way. So sure. yeah, but it's for sure. bad. It's
yeah.
bad.
Yeah, apparently, I guess Ted Turner had seriously considered running for president. I kind of feel like we're getting to see that alternative universe now.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's. I'm so glad you brought that up, because that was very fascinating in researching this, to see that he, you know, he loved the power and the glory and the money associated mm-hmm. with this media empire he'd built. And he thought, I'll just run for president. And it's impossible to imagine that he could have, although people have said that about, you know, the man who's president now. So right. who knows what would have happened if he had run. Yeah. But Jane Fonda, when she married him, said, don't even think about it. So maybe it's Jane's fault that it didn't happen. The other Jane, when he was married to before, I don't think she would have been so keen about it either. But she was a different woman.
Well, again, the book is called Up All Night, Ted Turner, CNN, and the Birth of 24-Hour News. Lisa Napoli, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Lisa Napoli for coming on the show. Order Up All Night, Ted Turner, CNN, and the Birth of 24-Hour News on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow Lisa at lisanapoli.com or on Twitter at Lisa Napoli. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.